Thank you very much, Alex, for the introduction. And yeah, apologies in advance because some of the slides are going to be really tiny. So I'm really sorry for that. I didn't realize this in advance. So I'm going to talk today about this recent project that is entitled Spectral Gap Implies Rapid Mixing for Commuting Hamiltonians. And I'm very happy to present it here because it's the last step for the time being of a larger project on modified logarithmic Sobolev inequalities for quantum many body systems, which has been done in collaboration with many people that are going to appear during the talk. And in particular, this last paper is done in collaboration with Álvaro Alhambra, Jan Kochanowski, and Cambis Rousset. And Álvaro Alhambra was previously a postdoc here for a few years, so I think he will be familiar to many of you. And before starting, oh, that's super helpful, thanks a lot. Sorry. Let's quit.
Yeah, it should be fine if you just...
Yeah, perfect. Thank you very much. It's much better. Yeah, thanks. And of course, before starting, I want to thank Perimeter Institute and in particular the Simon Seminator Fellowship Program for, you know, funding me to be here these 2 months, because it's great to be here on this long research stay. And I've been able to interact with a lot of people and everything, so I really want to acknowledge this thing and thank them again for the opportunity. And now I want to start talking about this project. So first of all, let me give motivation and a background of the things we're going to be talking about. So this project is going to be, it's going to concern open quantum many body systems. And the reason why we're working with them is, of course, because we all know that no experiment that we perform can be really executed at zero temperature or be completely shielded from noise. This is why we really need to assume, if we want to model some kind of experiment that is relatively realistic, that we have an open, that we have a quantum many body system that is contained in an environment that is going to be usually for us a heat bath. And the particular feature that we are going to assume in this project is that the interactions between the system and the environment are weak, in the sense that we have a weak coupling. And this is going to allow us to assume Markovianity, essentially. So this is, this is not what I want, probably. Oh, yeah. So this, okay, you can imagine that. What I'm writing there is just some notation so that we are familiar with the notation that I'm going to be using during the talk. I'm just going to use lambda to denote the lattice in which we're going to be working all the time. And in principle, we're going to be working in dimension D. And we're going to consider the global Hilbert space associated to the whole lattice as a tensor product of all the local Hilbert spaces. And this is how we are going to denote the density matrices in each system lambda. And well, as I said, we're going to consider the case in which we have an interaction between the system and the environment. So the initial energy that we have on the system is going to tend to dissipate with time. And in particular, we are going to assume that we can model the continuous time evolution of an initial state on the system by a quantum Markov semigroup by the so-called Markovian approximation. And by this Markovian approximation, or by this quantum Markov semigroup, for those of you that are not super familiar with the notion, what I mean is that we have a semigroup of channels that is indexed in one parameter that is going to be the time, essentially. So this is why it's a continuous parameter. And as I said, yeah, it's a semigroup of channels. So it's a semigroup of completely positive and trace-preserving maps. So it's going to map density matrices to density matrices. And because of being a semigroup, it satisfies these two properties here. So it satisfies that when you consider the element of the semigroup at instant t and compose it with the element at instant s, we get the element at instant t plus s. And the initial element of the semigroup is just the identity. And we are going to be working all the time on finite lattices and finite dimensional Hilbert spaces associated to them, which means that everything here is going to be finite dimensional. Okay, so there's no problem with possible features that could happen in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. And what we know in particular, because of having the structure of a semigroup, is that there is an operator that is going to be denoted by L that is going to be the infinitesimal generator of the semigroup. And it's going to be satisfying this equation that I'm writing here, which is usually called a Master's equation or Liouville's equation, depending on where you check. And this is telling us that if we differentiate with respect to time the element of the semigroup at instant t, this is the same as composing this infinitesimal generator by the left side and by the right side with the element at instant t. And therefore, this allows us to write each element of the semigroup at instant t as the exponential with time and this infinitesimal generator. Okay, so the nice feature, the nice mathematical feature of having this structure behind all the description of our process is that we are going to be able to write each element at every instant t by this expression here, where this L is going to be it's going to be called by us Limpladian. I mean, it's called Limpladian because it comes from the GKLS equation, where L was Limplad. And this GKLS equation is something that has the form that I'm writing here, essentially. So I'm not going to go into details there, but this is the usual form of the generator that can be obtained when taking all the assumptions that we're considering on the semigroup above. Okay? And this is, for the moment, the mathematical object that we are considering for the description of these dynamics. And we have to assume a couple of things for our problem to be tractable. So the first thing that we have to do is, well, I'm going to be talking, this is something that I want to clarify, I'm going to be talking about mixing all the time. And by mixing, I'm only talking about convergence. So what I'm going to be studying from now on is how a quantum Markov semigroup converges to their fixed point. And the first thing that we are going to do is assume that there is a unique fixed point. So anytime that we consider a quantum Markov semigroup, we are going to assume that they have a unique invariant state and a unique fixed point, which means that the infinitesimal generator has a unique density matrix on its kernel. So these two things are equivalent. And we are further going to assume that this unique fixed point is going to be full rank, and this is going to be for simplicity in the operations. Otherwise, some other things can be translated, but for the time being, let's not deal with these complications. And this is the first thing that we have to assume. This guarantees that our semigroup is going to converge. But now we want to be able to really work with this convergence in a proper way. And for that, we have to further assume something that is called detail balance condition, which essentially tells us that if now we consider, instead of the infinitesimal generator for density matrices, so in the Schrödinger picture, we take the dual map in the Heisenberg picture, and this dual map comes just from a composing the initial infinitesimal generator that we were considering from the Schrödinger picture, and mapping it, sandwiching it with the fixed point on the right side and on the left side by sigma 1/2, which is the state that we're considering here, then applying our Limpladian, and then applying the sigma minus 1/2 and sigma minus 1/2. So if we consider this map that brings to duality, then if we consider this scalar product that is called KMS scalar product and is written by this expression here, so it tells us that when we consider the product between F and G with sigma, this is just a trace of F sigma 1/2 and G sigma 1/2. So what this detail balance condition tells us is that essentially this dual infinitesimal generator is self-adjoint with respect to this scalar product. Okay? And this, in a sense, is telling you that the physics that you are describing with this process is reversible. So this is why this property is usually called also reversible, because it gives you some reversibility in the process.
Question?
Yeah?
How general is this condition?
That's a good question. Depends on who you ask. So for the models that we are considering here and that we're considering later, this is always satisfied. So for Davis generators, for example, or for something that we are also considering later that is called Hilbert generator and all these things, this is always satisfied. Of course, when you are, okay, when I say that this is always satisfied, I should say that it's because we are considering sigma to be the Gibbs state of a commuting Hamiltonian, of a local commuting Hamiltonian, otherwise this is not so clear. If you go for more general Limpladians, this is not so clear when it's satisfied and when it's not. And also, here I'm taking the KMS scalar product. Some other people work with the GNS scalar product, which just has a trace of sigma and then F and G. This is slightly different. Some other people work with the BKM scalar product, which is an integral of considering a combination with T and 1 minus T in the powers. These three notions are a bit different, and there are like examples of different Limpladians satisfying some conditions and not satisfying the others. So this condition is pretty general, but it's not always satisfied, let's say that.
I see.
But at least for the physical models we're going to consider later, it's always satisfied.
So for Gibbs states, it can prove to be satisfied, right?
For Gibbs states and for Davis dynamics. So for this specific Limbladian that we will see later that models Davis dynamics, which is acceptable in the community, I think, usually to model these kind of processes. So for these cases, it's always satisfied. But of course, when you have sigma that behaves in a different way, that is not a Gibbs state, for example, is something in general, it's more difficult to check whether this is satisfied.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Shouldn't ask without raising hands.
Okay.
You please.
I was wondering if this is a, if this seems to be a, also a property of the state. So is this a property of the state or the dynamics, the detailed balance condition?
The two things are quite related, no? So, I mean, it's really a property of the Limbladian, but the Limbladian is univocally defined from the state in this particular case. Because it's the fixed point of the Limbladian. So in a sense?
Okay. Oh, choosing a fixed point defines the Limbladian, actually.
Not really. But we are kind of tricking these things here, because the Gibbs state comes from this Hamiltonian, and this with these couplings with the bath, you have to trick them so that you have a unique fixed point.
Okay.
So it's not really that given a unique fixed point, sorry, that given a Gibbs state, you have a unique Limbladian such that this is the fixed point. Actually, I think this is an open problem that is very complicated and everything. But taking into account the conditions that we're imposing, you don't have so much freedom to choose like a whole range of Limbladians. So, but yeah, in this case, I feel that this property is a property of both, in a sense.
Can I ask, so this full roundness doesn't matter, like it's just technical, you can just...
It's just technical.
So just define the other, the product as be just a support would be enough or something.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter.
The thing is that for some of the properties that I will introduce later, like Lochsova-Levine inequalities and these things, defining it with something that is not full rank is a bit annoying. Mm-hmm. But for the mixing time, for example, this is something that is perfectly fine. And actually something that is interesting for many people for some applications, because they really want to see that you have pure states, for example, and see what happens. So very far from full rank. But
okay.
But yeah, it's for some of the techniques. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just curious, let's say you have the easy model at low temperature, so the fixed point is not unique. That is still true, this kind of condition?
You mean that if this condition is true?
Yeah.
This is independent of having a unique fixed point.
Oh.
So you can have this for a certain fixed point and not have primitivity, and then you're not going to have this kind of convergence that is so streamlined. Because you can have, I mean, like in these dynamical processes in which you have different attractor points, no, and you can have some weird behaviors. So, I mean, here what we are doing is essentially guaranteeing that you don't have weird behaviors around some of these fixed points, but you really have some, I should say, like some attraction sink or something like that, so that really your process converges. But you can definitely have this, of course, something different. Yeah, so the idea of defining all this formalism is that now, if you consider a density matrix on your system lambda, and you let it evolve with time, after a certain time t, because of having a quantum Markov semigroup, we are going to be able to describe it like this, because that was the whole point, no? Of being able to describe it as an exponential with time of the infinitesimal generator applied to this density matrix. And because of having these properties, we have guaranteed that after an infinite time, we're going to have convergence to this fixed point that we were taking because of the primitivity assumption. So convergence is always going to happen in these particular cases. And now the question that we are going to address here is how fast this convergence happens. So,
last question.
Yeah.
You mean if the detailed balance is satisfied, then the convergence must happen?
The primitivity and the detail balance in these two conditions.
Okay, why is needed? Why these two conditions are needed?
Actually, the one that is really important is the primitivity, because the primitivity, what is telling you, I mean, if you look at the eigenvalues of the semigroup,
yeah.
This is essentially telling you that you have a unique eigenvalue of modulus 1 that is actually going to be the one. And this is going to tell you that since all the other eigenvalues are smaller, this is going to give you the attraction of the semigroup to the fixed point.
Yeah.
So the convergence is going to be given by that. And then the streamline convergence, so the fact that it doesn't oscillate, is going to be given by the detail balance condition.
Oh.
So it's just because of that. So this detail balance condition, I will show a graph later, but what this tells you is that when you consider, for example, the relative entropy between the evolved state and the equilibrium, it's going to do like this.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't have detailed balance, it could be like this.
But it still decays to zero, right?
Decays to zero, but oscillating. And in, assuming this, it decays to zero like this. So it's just for, again, for being able, you know, for being better for our techniques. Okay, so what we are going to study now is how fast this convergence happens for specific models that we're going to consider here. And of course, by these models, what I mean is we are given certain Hamiltonian, because I already told you that the fixed point is going to be the Gibbs state of a certain Hamiltonian. And we are given a certain Limbladian. And then we want to see whether for this combination of Limbladian and Hamiltonian, the mixing time of this evolution is going to be fast enough or not. And by this mixing time, what I mean is that if you consider a ball that is centered in your fixed point sigma and has a radius epsilon, I mean, the mixing time of the semigroup is going to be the minimum instant of time such that all the possible initial evolutions of, so all the possible initial density matrices after being evolved this certain time t have already fallen inside this ball of center your fixed point and radius epsilon. So this means, in a sense, that after this mixing time, your state has become almost indistinguishable from the equilibrium, in a sense. So this is the way in which we are going to measure how fast our system is mixing, or how fast our system is converging. And the particular property that we want to satisfy is something that is called rapid mixing, which is something that tells us that actually this epsilon that I was writing here for the radius of the ball is something that decays exponentially with time. That's something that can be proven to happen always for these cases, for these models, for the form that they have, but something that scales with the system size only polynomially. Okay, so the natural thing, or relatively natural thing that can be heuristically proven for this kind of systems, is that since you have here a Gibbs state of a local Hamiltonian, of a local commuting Hamiltonian, this can be shown in general to be scaling exponentially with the system size. This is something that is reasonable for many of these models. The part that is complicated is to get something that gives you some exponential improvement with respect to that. So in the sense that something that gives you something that scales only polynomially with system size. This is the part that is highly non-trivial. And this is something that tells you, of course, that the mixing time is much faster, because what it's telling you is that when you increase the size of the lattice, the mixing time is not growing a lot, no? In the sense that this thing is only bounded by something that is polynomial with the system size. So in particular, this is the upper bound for the supremum of all possible initial density matrices evolved after time t, seeing how far they are from the equilibrium. And this translates as having some mixing time with the definition here, scaling polylogarithmically with the system size. Okay, so as long as we have some mixing time that scales polylogarithmically with the size of lambda, we are in this regime. And now, well, the whole purpose of this project is to be able to show that for these kind of models, you have rapid mixing, so you have examples of rapid mixing. And the reason why we want to do that is because of the implications that we've seen rapid mixing to have for many different purposes in quantum information. So there are two aspects that I like to see from rapid mixing. There are like some negative aspects and some positive aspects. And the negative point of view of this property, in a sense, is that if you assume, for example, that your initial density matrix is the ground state, and you really want to see, you know, you're encoding some information on the ground state of a Hamiltonian, and you have some properties there that want to survive for a while, and you're approaching the Gibbs state, which is the equilibrium of the process, if you approach it too fast, that means essentially that the properties that you store on the ground state are suppressed too fast to be of reasonable use, right? And this is why having rapid mixing for some properties, for some applications in this direction is pretty bad. But at the same time, we have some positive point of views, which are like in the opposite direction. In particular, the most important one, in my opinion so far, is that thermal states for which the mixing time is small can be constructed efficiently with a quantum device that simulates the effect of the thermal bath. And of course, this has many applications as a self-studying open problem itself, and also, for example, for optimization problems via simulated type algorithms of annealing. And now, yeah?
So this, I guess I have two questions. One, does this approach work for like generalized Gibbs states too, or is it strictly just energy being conserved? like if I have like some conserved quantity and a generalized Gibbs ensemble instead of just having a thermal state like a Gibbs state, does the formalism still apply to that case, or does like conservation laws break things down?
I think one would have to check each particular model to see if they satisfy specifically the properties that we are discussing here or not. Because in a sense, this is pretty limited. This is pretty rigid with the properties that we were imposing before. So, okay. Of course, this is satisfied for some quantum Gibbs samplers that are kind of natural. Like for this Davis dynamics, for example, I think this is kind of natural. But I don't know how much more flexible this is.
And then another question. So this gives us a way to characterize like the time it takes for a system to thermalize.
Yeah.
In general, is like someone who doesn't study that very often, what makes that hard to do? Like, why is determining how fast it takes for a system to thermalize challenging, just like at a high level? I don't know if that's an easy question to answer or not.
I don't know if it's easy. I don't know. I mean, if you try to compute it ad hoc, I guess, physically, I cannot give you any reason, but mathematically, I don't know, computing the supremum of something in which you really don't have a lot of information is usually complicated, right? Because it's a variational problem in which you really don't have a lot of a structure of things that you can use there. And at least with the techniques that I will show you later, you provide some techniques that are actually even harder to compute than this one, I think. But then you are able to reduce it to some other techniques that are easier, in a sense. So I mean, the main problem of this property is that you are considering an infinite amount of density matrices, of initial density matrices, and you are considering an infinite amount of instants of time, right? And I don't know, proving something like that, I don't see how to do it very easily if you really want to study this property as a dynamical property. The whole magic of this strategy that we follow here is that you can reduce what happens dynamically for this process to something that happens statically only on the Gibbs state.
So to make sure I understand that, so yeah. As an alternative, like let's say someone said, okay, I'll measure some single state observable
yeah.
and measure the expectation value over time and see how long it takes for that expectation value to agree with the thermal expectation value. That seems like it wouldn't be hard to do, but I'm guessing that doesn't tell you what you want, right?
As far as I know, no.
So like, why does that not do that then? And like, we would use something like this instead.
Yes, it depends exactly on what you're considering there, but what you're saying, for example, is something that is discrete, no? So it's something that is a discrete process. So in a sense, it's a discretized version of this problem, and it's something that is completely different, I guess.
Oh, I thought we were on a lattice. My bad.
No, we are on a lattice, but not on discrete times. Because you're saying applying something a number of times, right?
You could do that computation, but you would choose some initial state. Calculate that expectation value, and she's saying you have to look at all possible initial states.
I see. So this covers a lot more initial states than
this covers all possible states, right? Because you have a supremum over all possible density matrix. This is why I said that. I mean, if you had some variational nice structure, I feel you could do something. But with this,
I see.
Yes.
But maybe just on that point. I mean, like you're, I think, proposing some kind of experimental protocol. But I think even if you just wanted to look at convergence of a single observable, it would not be easy to like do that. I mean, like on a, you know, in math, for example, to compute the expected value of that observable as this process goes on, I don't think is an efficient method for doing that.
Because of the continuous in time part of it. Like, I get
no, because we're talking about like a, I mean, I guess you could simulate perhaps this Lindblad-ian on a quantum computer, but.
Yeah.
But you know, in math, it's not easy to. You know, in the same way that quantum simulation, like, isn't easy.
Thank you.
Yeah. So maybe later I will convince you a bit more about these things, but we'll see. We'll see. Yeah, but I mean, for the timing, I just want to convince you more or less in general why we are interested in rapid mixing and why this property has nice implications in quantum information or quantum computing. And there are many things that we can say about this, of course, but I don't want to go into many details here. So the only thing that maybe I want to highlight is that we want to use this essentially as a no-go criterion to discriminate some models for self-error correction or for quantum memories, in the sense that it's generally believed, as far as I know, that for having a system that could act that would be a nice candidate for a quantum memory and having self-correction and everything, the mixing time would be expected to be exponentially with the system size. And what we are proving here, or what we are in the direction of proving here, is that something is logarithmic with the system size, or that is polylogarithmic with the system size. And this would essentially tell us that the initial again, what I said before, no, that the initial density matrix considered on the system converges too fast to the thermal equilibrium, so that you don't have time to really make self-correction before you lose all the information. So this is why this is usually employed, as far as I know, as a criterion to discriminate systems from being good candidates for quantum memories. And apart from that, there are many other nice applications of this property in different contexts. And maybe another thing that we like quite a lot is that this is believed to be a rapid mixing is believed to be a nice criterion to discriminate phase transitions in matter, dissipative phase transitions, which means that if you always have, if you consider a certain model and you study the whole range of temperatures of this model, and you see that you always have rapid mixing, that the mixing time doesn't go below that, then this means essentially that there's no dissipative phase transition in this model with respect to the temperature, and this is something that we are using, for example, in 1D to say that all these Davis generators in 1D have the same rapid mixing, and therefore there are no dissipative phase transitions there. So this is also some direction that we are considering. And okay, I won't talk much more about the applications.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
I mean, I am on Zoom. So, I mean, if I understand correctly, I mean, in the context of topological matter, quantum matter, I mean, what you are describing in some way, just talking, you know, from the state point of view, what you are talking about is thermal fragility, is what in condensed matter we call this thermal fragility. That is the fact that if you encode information, you know, in these logical, you know, bits,
yeah.
Essentially, this will decay pretty fast. Okay, so this kind of topological protection is not there. But, you know, when you are addressing those things, what you are looking at are operators that are string operators. You know, these are, you know, these two cross two string objects. And the question is, because, you know, there was this question about expectation values and how expectation values decay. So, but these are expectation values of non-local operators. So is that what you are going to show? That whenever, or you are going to show just that the states themselves, they have a rapid mixing, but you are not going to say anything about the way the correlators of the string operators decay.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So actually, yeah, what we will see later is that, well, the property that, I mean, the object that has rapid mixing is going to be the Limbladian or the semigroup. This is kind of related to the state, but actually, I mean, this property is a property of the semigroup. And yeah, you're completely right. There's a small caveat, at least in the 1D case, for example, which is that when we are using it to describe this, what I was saying about dissipative phase transitions, of course, we're considering that the model there has only some weak symmetries in a sense. So some other models that are considered in the literature that talk about strong symmetries and everything are not covered by this approach. So in particular, I think it's related to what you are saying about these string operators not being covered by this.
Okay. Okay. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, okay. So now, before, when I had the first slide on here on the screen, I told you that this is part of a bigger project in something that is called Modified Logarithmic Sobolev Inequalities for Quantum Many-Body Systems. And the whole point is that when we started working with this rapid mixing property, we realized that it was difficult to tackle it directly. And looking at the classical literature for classical spin systems, we realized that some functional inequality that is frequently used there to imply rapid mixing is something that is called the logarithmic Sobolev inequality, or something that is the modified logarithmic Sobolev inequality. And here we focus on the modified case, because the one that is not modified in the quantum case doesn't make a lot of sense, because even in some particular cases, it's already shown that it doesn't hold, so it's not useful at all. But we are going to introduce now this modified logarithmic Sobolev inequality, this MLSI, and we are going to show that it implies rapid mixing with a very short proof here. And the idea is that if we consider a density matrix rho and we consider its evolution after time t, and we consider again the master equation that I was writing before, which is the one that tells you about this infinitesimal generator. Now, if you consider the relative entropy between the evolved system, the evolved state, and the equilibrium state, this is just a way of measuring the distance between these two states, right? So we are going to consider this way of measuring. And what we are going to do is differentiate with respect to time and apply the Maxwell equation that we had before. And if we differentiate with respect to time this evolved relative entropy, what we obtain is this expression that I'm writing here. And because of what we were saying before, of the detailed balance condition and all these features of the semi-group that we are considering, yeah, it's visible. We are going to have a function like the one that I'm drawing there, in a sense, because what we are having here is a relative entropy between two density matrices at every instant of time, which means that this is always larger than or equal to zero. But at the same time, we know that rho t is converging to sigma, which means that in the limit, this is going to go to zero. So what we have is a larger than or equal function, so a positive function that is tending to zero, which is decreasing. And of course, this also means that the derivative, the modulus of the derivative, is also going to be decreasing, which means that we are able to find an inequality between the relative entropy and minus its derivative. And it's clear that this inequality is going to be true for a certain alpha that we can find for each particular instant of time and for each particular rho. And of course, the challenge now is to find a universal alpha that holds always. So a universal alpha that you can put in this inequality so that this is always true for every rho and for every t and only depends on sigma. And if this alpha exists and is non-trivial, because of course you can always put a zero there, no? But if this alpha is non-zero, then it's when we say that we have a modified logarithmic Sobolev inequality. This is essentially the modified logarithmic Sobolev inequality.
Sorry, just a maybe silly question. Why does the derivative look like that? Like there's only a derivative of the rho t and not the log rho t. Something happened.
That part disappears, it's traceless.
Oh.
When you differentiate the second part, it's traceless.
Okay, yeah.
So it disappears.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, otherwise it would be like, yeah exactly, it would appear. Yes. So of course the natural candidate that you would try to think of, no, for this alpha that I was trying to find here would be just taking the quotient between the right-hand side and the left-hand side and taking the infimum there, no? And then this would be the natural constant that you would like to put so that this inequality is always true. And now someone could complain, or maybe not, but as I'm defining it here, I'm saying that we are interested in the case in which this alpha is non-zero. And actually, since we are considering finite dimensional systems all the time, this alpha is going to be non-zero because of how we are defining the Limbladian and how we are considering the relative entropy. Because these Limbladians that we are considering, we will see that later, are chosen so that the kernel of the numerator and the denominator of this fraction that we are considering there coincide. And we are always going to have some positive elements there. So when we take the infimum, since this is a compact, it's still going to be positive. And then you would say, OK, you are cheating because this is always positive. And it's true. For every lambda, this is true. But from now on, every time that I talk about the existence of an MLSI, I'm really not talking about the existence of an MLSI. I'm talking about the limit. Because now what we are really interested in is a family of lattices that grow to the thermodynamic limit. And what we want is that in the limit, this MLSI constant is positive. So that this essentially means that each of the alphas is going to be positive, but might depend on lambda. If it depends on lambda very badly, then that means that in the limit, this thing could go to zero, and then the system would not have this positive MLSI that we require for rapid mixing to hold. However, we will say later that there's an exception. This could still depend with lambda, as long as this goes to zero very slowly. We will see later what this means. But in particular, let's assume for the time being that this limit is positive, and then we can integrate in a uniform way this MLSI that I was describing before, so that we can write it essentially as some decay rate from some exponential decay rate for the relative entropy between the evolved state and the equilibrium in terms of the initial relative entropy between the initial state and the equilibrium. And then if we put this now together with Pinsker's inequality, what we obtain is the following. So if you remember, when we were trying to describe rapid mixing, what we were doing was to upper bound the one norm of the distance between the evolved state and the equilibrium, right? So now putting this together with Pinsker's inequality, we have an upper bound for the one norm in terms of the initial relative entropy between the state, any state, and the equilibrium. And of course, the result that we are writing here, we want it to be true for any initial density matrix, which means that we have to consider the worst case scenario to bound this inequality. And the worst case scenario happens when rho is a projection onto the minimal eigenspace of sigma. And in that particular case, the value of this is the log of the inverse of the minimal eigenvalue of sigma. So this is one of the reasons that we are considering something that is full rank, so that we don't have to think about any complications here. And now, this is why I said that, in general, this is going to be, I mean, in the case in which we, instead of having the relative entropy here, we have some variance and we have spectral gap and all these things, we will see that later. This term is going to be shown to be exponential in general with the system size. But as I said, we want something that is polynomial. And therefore, since we are considering thermal states of local commuting Hamiltonians, this minimal eigenvalue is usually going to scale like 1 over exponential of the system size. And here, we have that this behaves like log of 1 over the minimal eigenvalue of sigma, which means that that's poly with the system size. Right? So this is why having an MLSI gives you rapid mixing. Because having an MLSI gives you an upper bound for the one norm distance between rho d and sigma in terms of something that is polynomial with the system size and something that decays exponentially fast with time, where now the rate is given by the MLSI constant. Okay? So this is the whole trick. This is the whole magic behind this thing. And as I said before, the main difference with respect to just considering another kind of functional inequality, which comes from the spectral gap of the Limbladian seen as a Hamiltonian, is that in that particular case, the bound that we would obtain here would be of the square root of 1 over sigma mean, and this thing would only be, in general, exponential with the system size. So this would be too large. Okay, so this is why we're not interested in that case. Okay, so until here, I'm just saying we wanted to prove rapid mixing, and now we have a sufficient condition for rapid mixing, so now we want to prove MLSIs. That's it. And now is when the tiny slides start, so I'm very sorry for this. So with a bit of imagination, we wanted to prove rapid mixing. We have a sufficient condition, that is this MLSI. I mean, the things that are written below is just to remind you about the concepts that were defined before. And as I was saying, if you consider the analogous inequality, but now for the spectral gap of the Limbladian as seen as a Hamiltonian, what we know is that this outputs some slower mixing that is not good enough. And we know that in general, it doesn't imply rapid mixing, or at least it's not easy to show, or it's not possible to show that it implies rapid mixing. But we know that the other arrow is true, that rapid mixing implies this spectral gap, so this Poincaré inequality. But again, what we were saying before, I mean, this is something that is dynamical. So it's something that if you want to prove it, you have to prove it for every density matrix and for every instant of time. And this is not easy to do in general, except for very, very specific particular cases of some models. So what people did many years ago for classical spin systems was to be able to relate this to some static conditions that only hold on the Gibbs state to which this dynamics is converging. And this is what we've been trying to explore also in the quantum setting. And by this, what we are going to do is show that certain forms of decay of correlations on the Gibbs state are going to imply these kind of properties for the semigroups. And by this, I mean, I'm going to give like a super, super short summary on what we are trying to do here. So let's forget about the semigroup for the time being. Let's forget about time. There's no time here. We are just considering Gibbs states of local Hamiltonians, and we are going to describe their correlation properties. And there are many different ways of describing that, of course. So in general, what we are going to consider is a lattice like this, and we are going to consider two spatially separated regions, A and B. And then we are going to write a local Hamiltonian that we can write as the sum of terms in that live in the bulk of A, live in B, and that live in the complement, and then terms that live in the boundary of A and terms that live in the boundary of B. And in general, the Gibbs state is given by this definition there, no? And there are a few questions that we can ask here. First of all, if now we put A and B adjacent, or at least so that their boundaries overlap, for non-commuting Hamiltonians, how far is the exponential of the Hamiltonian in AB to the product of the exponentials of the Hamiltonian in A and B? So how much do the overlapping terms change this expression? And even in this particular case in which the A and B are separated, what happens if we go a bit further and even and instead of considering the local Gibbs states, so instead of considering just the Hamiltonians on these restricted regions, we consider partial traces. So we are tracing out essentially what happens in the complement of A and in the complement of B. How far is that from what happens in the complement of A union B? And to answer these questions, or at least to try to solve these questions, some measures of correlations have been explored in the past few years. And here we are going to consider these three that I'm writing. First of all, the most standard one, I guess, this operator correlation or this covariance, or it has many names. It's just given by the expression that I'm writing there. And this is supposed to be the weakest form of measuring of correlations on Gibbs states, at least among the ones that I'm describing here. And it's the most standard one. Then, of course, another way to measure that is the mutual information. So it's just the relative entropy between the state in AB and now the tensor product of the marginals of the state in A and B. And there's another one that is actually inspired in some works of classical spin systems that is called mixing condition. And if you see, it's also a way to measure how far sigma AB is from being a tensor product between A and B. Because, of course, when sigma is a tensor product between A and B, this thing is just zero. And the only thing that I want to highlight here is that there's this hierarchy between these three quantities. So the mixing condition is the largest one. And then you have the mutual information. And then we have the square of this covariance with the 1/2 factor. OK, so just to give you an example of some measures of correlations that can be used. And the reason why I'm bringing them here is because, first of all, it was shown in this paper by Castorian and Brandao that having a spectral gap for the Limbladian implies having exponential decay on the covariance, on this weakest measure of correlation. And analogously, having rapid mixing implies some exponential decay on the mutual information. So these are like reasonable quantities to explore in this context. And now what we've just seen is that having exponential decay in the mutual in the mixing condition implies the same thing for the mutual information and implies the same thing for the covariance. So of course now we have a lot of arrows here with a lot of boxes, but again, we want to arrive at the rapid mixing, which means that we would like to have some arrow coming from here to this part here, either to the MLSI or to the rapid mixing directly, and this is what we explore essentially. So all the things that we've been working on have to do with showing that this form of mixing condition implies an MLSI for certain models, and this implies rapid mixing. Yeah.
So on the maybe the previous slide or the one before, you had questions.
Yeah.
And one of them was, like the first one, for non-commuting Hamiltonians, is this true? So will that be answered or? OK, so this is just motivation for?
It's motivation for studying this. The problem is that here we are only exploring commuting Hamiltonians. So we have some partial results, actually, for non-commuting Hamiltonians. But I don't know how successful they are for these purposes.
I guess maybe just more broadly, like how does that question relate to the things that we're talking about?
This in particular, yeah. Not a lot. This is just for motivation. Since we are always using marginals of states, the one that really relates is the second one.
Got it. Thanks.
But yeah, the first one, no. Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's kind of hidden because when we prove this condition, we actually have to decompose it in all the local Gibbs states and combine stuff and everything. So it's kind of hidden in the proof, but. But it's not really, it doesn't really show up.
Is it true that the approaches to that question always involve the like exponentials of positive, like positive and negative imaginary times?
I think so, yeah. At least the ones that I know, yeah.
Okay.
Yes,
thanks.
Exactly. Thank you. Yeah, okay, so this is the starting point of all this family of results that we've been cooking in these past few years. And just to summarize this part, what we are doing essentially is we are given a Hamiltonian that is a local commuting Hamiltonian with which we construct a Gibbs state. And we are given a local Limbladian that has a unique fixed point, a unique stationary state that is exactly this Gibbs state. And then we have the following questions. So first of all, does the Limbladian have a positive constant MLSI or even polylog, because this is enough for having rapid mixing? And the second question is, how do correlations decay on the Gibbs state between spatially separated regions? Because in a sense, this is what we are going to use to imply rapid mixing. And now we have a few examples. I guess I shouldn't go into much detail because it's probably getting a bit late.
Can I ask a quick question, clarification?
Yeah.
When you are saying H lambda is local commuting Hamiltonian,
yes,
you specifically refer to the fact that these two regions you are separating are commuting, or there is more structure?
No.
When you're
no.
saying commuting, is more structure in the Hamiltonian, it's only the two, the HA, HB, et cetera,
no.
et cetera.
No, no, thank you for the question. No, no, it's important to clarify this. It's much more structured. So you really have a K-local Hamiltonian in the sense that each of the terms composing the Hamiltonian only has support on K sites. And each of
yes.
these, and each of the terms that compose the Hamiltonian commute pairwise. So it's not only an A and B,
oh, okay.
it's all the terms commute pairwise.
Oh, okay, okay, okay. It's more restriction. Okay,
it's much more
okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
But yeah, another 15 minutes.
Okay, then perfect. Okay, thanks. Then I can still continue. Okay, so maybe just to give you an intuition of you know, the techniques that we've been using here, because I feel that they could be also relevant for some other contexts. So what we are trying to prove is that this thing is positive, as I said, or at least that even if we can lower bound this by something that depends on the size of lambda, either this thing is positive or it goes to zero very slowly, like inversely polylogarithmically with the system size. And we want to prove something of the sort. And the reason is the following. So if we are given lambda, and now we can consider a subregion of lambda that is A, that is fixed, that is not growing with lambda, so that we can reduce our MLSI in lambda to the MLSI in A by paying some factor that only depends on A, and then we show that this thing is positive, then we are done. Because now we take here limit with lambda, and everything is fine. This is what we would like to have, and this is actually what happens in the classical case. But quantumly, this is very rarely going to happen, because quantum systems are much more complicated. And in particular, there's something that is called DLR conditions, which are satisfied classically and not quantumly, that completely destroy this inequality. So in general, we are not going to be able to have this, but we are going to be able to show something like this. And this is going to be something that we define here that still has some information on lambda. And it's something that we call a conditional MLSI in A, because it still has the information of lambda, and the states that it's considering still live in lambda. But it's really conditioned onto A on a certain form that we will see later. So this is the kind of inequality we are going to work with. And well, now we have to describe a whole process how to do this reduction. And for that, we inspired ourselves in the classical case, and then we had to readapt all the tools because of what I said, because the quantum case gets much more involved. So the first thing that we had to do is define something that is called a conditional MLSI on this subregion A of lambda. And the way to do that was just to take the definition in the general case, so in the global case. And one important thing that we haven't used so far and now we have to use is that we have a Lambdadian that is local in the sense that it's additive with respect to the index. So essentially, the Lambdadian in lambda can be written as a sum of Lambdadians that are indexed in K of lambda. Of course, that doesn't mean that they live there. They live there in some neighboring sites, but whatever. This is just a way to write this with respect to the index. And that means essentially that if we consider now a conditional MLSI on a subregion, the numerator is pretty easy to define, because the only thing that we have to do is take here LA, and LA is just going to be the terms of this sum that have index in A. Okay, so this part is easy. The part in the denominator, of course, is going to be much more complicated. And for this, we have to define something that we call a conditional relative entropy, and that is going to be defined differently depending on the case, because we are going to be readjusting the proof depending on the necessities, I guess. And once we have this definition of a conditional MLSI, we have to follow this kind of puzzle structure that we've always been following. And this has like five different steps or pieces. The first one, and the one at the core, is defining this conditional Lobsky-Volev constant. And the one that I put outside is a study or assume some form of decay of correlations on the Gibbs state. Because these two things are really like the definition slash assumptions that you take on your system so that you are going to prove, so that you can prove rapid mixing for this system. And now there are three things that you have to prove once you are given these two assumptions. The first thing is going to be called a quasi-factorization of the relative entropy. Then we are going to need some geometric recursive argument, and then we are going to have to show that this conditional Lobsky-Volev constant that I was mentioning before is positive. And like right now, this is a bit abstract, but if I give a particular example, I guess this is, will be much more understandable. So first of all, let me describe this quasi-factorization of the relative entropy because it sounds a bit cryptic. This is nothing but an inequality of the form that I'm writing here. So essentially now you consider a tripartite system, ABC, and you have a relative entropy between two states in total ABC. And this quasi-factorization of the relative entropy is just an inequality that upper bounds this relative entropy in terms of something that is called conditional relative entropies in AB on the one side and in BC on the other side. And this multiplicative error term that you have to pay here, which is going to depend on how far sigma ABC is from being a tensor product between A and C, essentially. So how far the marginal sigma AC is from being a tensor product between sigma A and sigma C. And again, these are not things that we are taking out of the blue. These are things that are inspired in classical systems and all these things, but are readapted to these particular cases. And once you have an inequality of this form, the strategy to go from this global MLSI to the conditional MLSI is something like what I'm writing here. So remember that we wanted to prove something like this. So we first wanted to reduce this to this, and then we wanted to prove that this is positive. And then what we are going to do is choose carefully some conditions of decay of correlations on the Gibbs state, choose carefully the definition for the conditional MLSI. And once we have that, this quasi-factorization of the relative entropy is going to let us go from the global relative entropy that was here to the conditional relative entropy that was here. So the numerator, we said, that was straightforward to go from one to the other. The denominator is going to be able to achieve going from one to the other by this expression here. But if we did something like what we are doing in this picture here, we would only be able to split lambda between two regions that still depend with lambda. So when you take the limit with lambda, they are going to move with it, and this is not what you want. In order to be able to reduce this to some smaller region that doesn't evolve with lambda, you have to apply this infinitely many times. And this is why you have this geometric recursive argument, which is going to provide this multiplicative constant. And finally, once you're already at this level of reducing to the conditional MLSI and getting the correct multiplicative constant, you have to show that this thing is positive. And this is the last step of the puzzle, the last piece of the puzzle. And this is usually the piece that is more complicated in the process. So this is usually the most complicated part. OK, so this is just like a high-level explanation of how this strategy works. And now let me give you a very specific explanation of how this can be used to prove a positive MLSI for the generalized depolarizing semigroup. So the idea is that now the specific Limbladian that we are considering is given by this expression there. And this Limbladian is mathematically very nice, but physically it's a bit less motivated in general. But in this particular case, since it identifies with the depolarizing noise, it's quite interesting, I guess. So the idea is that you consider any density matrix row, and you trace out what happens in a site x of the lattice. You reconstruct it with your state sigma, and then you take the difference between this reconstructed state and your initial density matrix row, and you sum all these effects over the whole lattice. So this is how you construct the Limbladian. And of course, what we are considering is also that our fixed point is a tensor product everywhere. So, well, a very ideal case, I guess, but just as an illustration of how this works. And in this particular case, the conditional relative entropy that we are considering is the difference between the global relative entropy and the relative entropy in the complement of the region where we are conditioning, which is also that is something that is kind of reasonable if we think about how these quantities are defined. These conditional quantities are usually defined. And once we have these two notions there, so we have the condition of decay of correlations, which in this case is, well, no correlations. And we have the notion of MLSI or conditional MLSI, because we are defining the conditional relative entropy, so and they go one-to-one. So once we have these two definitions, we have to prove the three different pieces that I was saying before. So the first part is proving some quasi-factorization. This is something that we do, and we obtain that the relative entropy in the total system is upper bounded by the sum of all the conditional relative entropies in all the sites. And if you remember this thing that I was writing here, I told you that you could only put two systems here, and here you had to measure how far sigma was from being a tensor product, but in this case, this, it's a tensor product. This is why we don't get an error term. So this is why we just get a one there. And now here, we just put the definition of a conditional MLSI. And in the next step, I mean, the only thing that we are doing is just taking out the infimum of all these conditional MLSIs. So now we are left with the sum of all these local terms of the Lindblad-ian, which just gives us the total Lindblad-ian. So this is, in this case, this geometric recursive argument, which in this particular case is pretty easy, but because of the structure of the system. And then finally, one has to prove that this is positive or that this is lower bounded so that all these terms disappear. And we do it separately. And we show that this is lower bounded by 1/2. And all these terms disappear. And now if you see the global inequality, you have an inequality between the relative entropy and this term here, which was the term that appeared in the numerator of the definition of the MLSI, which means that now if you take quotient and take infimum, you are getting that your MLSI in this particular case is bounded by 1/2, it's lower bounded by 1/2, which means that in particular it's positive. Okay, so this is just some small example. And then of course, systems get much more complicated.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah.
So the question of factorizability of the relative entropy is something that can be proven for any systems.
Sorry, can you say that again?
The question of factorizability of a relative entropy
yeah.
is something you can prove for any systems.
So here you're not using anything about sigma for the moment.
Okay.
So this is something that you have to prove in general, mm-hmm. and the most general result that we have here. I mean, it involves some inequality, some error term, sorry, that depends on the marginals of sigma. Actually, it depends on the thing that I was calling mixing condition before. So that means that this is true as long as this mixing condition is smaller than 1/2, which is not super trivial, but usually when these things are measuring correlations between two spatially separated regions, you usually can move them far away so that this quantity is already smaller than 1/2, and then this result is true.
Uh-huh.
But you're not requiring anything else. I mean, there you're not requiring at all that sigma is a Gibbs state or anything like that.
Okay. And the, if you go two slides more, yeah, here, yeah. You use that inequality in the first, the second line.
Here.
Right?
Yeah.
Which subsystem corresponds to ABC?
So here, ABC would be everything. Mm-hmm. And here, this would be, for example, A. And then plus the same thing in B, plus the same thing in C. Oh. So you will have the three of them.
Okay.
And yeah, this is what I said, that you can do it three times because now you don't have an error term.
Thank
so
you.
This is why you can do that. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to skip most of the next things. The only thing that I want to say is that here we were using this heat bath generator, which was, from the mathematical point of view, it was very nice because it's something you can really work with. But in general, you're interested in proving stuff for Davis generators because they are the physically relevant ones. And something that we sometimes have to use along the way is something that is called Schmidt generators, for which the structural decomposition was initially introduced by Ravi and Viali a few years ago. And this, the whole idea of these Lindbladians is that they really look at what happens in the case in which you have two local Hamiltonians and how the algebras of these neighboring sites decompose, so that you can write this Lindbladian model in the evolution of some conditional expectation with which you can really work, and the distance between applying this conditional expectation to an observable and the observable itself. So without going into many detail here, what I want to tell you now is that there has been like a long way on this family of results. So the starting point goes back to Castellano and Brandão, 2016, in which they proved that both for the heat bath and for the Davis generator, in particular case in 1D, there is always a positive spectral gap, which is independent of the system size. And in higher dimensions, they proved the same thing, but at high enough temperature. And then what I was saying before is that if we have the heat bath and we have a tensor product fixed point, we have an MLSI. And the hope is to be able to lift this result from spectral gap to MLSI so that we can get rapid mixing. So this is why the starting point is here, and the hope is to be able to prove exactly the same, but for the MLSI. And there are a bunch of results here that have to do with different forms of quasi-factorizations, which are these blue boxes, and how they have been used to prove different forms of MLSI. So modified logarithmic solid inequalities, which are the orange boxes. So these are different examples, and these are some things that we can discuss individually, I mean, if anybody is interested. And in particular, before the result that I want to mention today, the last thing that we could do was to put together a few of these quasi-factorization results to be able to show that if we consider Davis generators in 1D at every temperature, we have, I mean, when the Gibbs state to which they are converging is the Gibbs state of a local commuting translation invariant Hamiltonian, then there's always a positive MLSI that depends logarithmically with the system size, and therefore there's always rapid mixing. So in this sense, if we take what we were saying about Castorian and Brandão, where they had the spectral gap, and we go again to the rapid mixing property and remember that having an MLSI implies rapid mixing, then since the rapid mixing property was giving you a bound of this form, having something that depends logarithmically with the system size, having some mixing time that depends logarithmically with the system size, still gives you something that is polynomial with the system size for this upper bound. And this is why having something that still depends logarithmically with the system size is enough to have rapid mixing. Okay, so this is the last thing that we have obtained before this. But now we can take a step further, and this is the last result that I want to mention today, which has to do with something similar to the diagram that I was mentioning before, but now we can really close the chain of implications that we were describing here. Because the point is that before we saw that we could go from MLSI to rapid mixing, and from rapid mixing to the spectral gap, and we know that spectral gap implies decay of the covariance. And what we can show now is that with decay of the covariance, we can go to something that is in principle stronger, which is this mixing condition. And actually, we can use some tricks to go from the mixing condition to the MLSI, which means that now if we put together all these arrows, we actually have a closed circle. And this is pretty interesting because this is telling us that now it's enough to prove a gap for the Limbladian, which is something that is easier to compute in many cases, like for example for toric codes or for quantum double models in general, is something that is known to exist. Or it's enough to have some exponential decay of the covariance on the Gibbs state, which is also something that is much more tractable than just having to prove the mixing condition itself. So the only caveats of this are that you have to consider a lattice that is a true colorable graph, which means that you don't have complete freedom in what you have to choose there, and that the Hamiltonian has to be true local. So only this only works so far for nearest neighbor interactions. And if you have that, and you have either of these two properties, either the Limbladian is gapped or there is exponential decay of correlations, then your Limbladian always has an MLSI. It has a constant MLSI when you have a subexponential graph, like for example for hypercubic lattices, and it has a logarithmically decreasing with the system size MLSI if the correlation length of the fixed point is sufficiently small, like I don't know, for BRE trees, for example. And this in particular has this corollary. So if we consider something that is 1D and the Hamiltonian is K local, then we always have for every temperature constant MLSI. If we have something that is a square lattice and we have two local interactions and a high enough temperature, then we always have a constant MLSI. And if we have a tree and we have two local interactions and also high enough temperature, then we have a logarithmically depending with the system size MLSI, but still this gives us rapid mixing, which is what we were looking for. And then I'm not going to bore you with the details anymore, but the only thing that I want to mention are some possible continuations of this, because let me just mention one thing here. There is one step of the proof that works for K-local interactions. So the part that relates decay of correlations works perfectly fine for K-local interactions. The problem is that there's some step of the proof in which we have to use these Schmidt decompositions, and this only works for two local interactions, and we are not able to get rid of that. So that means that, of course, something that we would like to have is the chain of implications that I was showing, so this circle of implications, but for K-local interactions. And this is not straightforward at all. Actually, this is pretty hard for the moment. We don't know how to do that. But this is the most natural extension of the results that we have here. And if not, we would just like to look at some specific models, because for example, as I was saying, for the toric code or for any quantum double model in general, we know that there's exponential degree of correlations, and we know that there's a positive spectral gap for every temperature. So it's only natural to think that one should be able to get rapid mixing for these models. So maybe there would be a way to adapt the proof so that we could obtain it. That's something that would be natural to explore as well. And one thing that I believe would be interesting would be to be able to really define all these different notions and some of these chain of implications for non-commuting Hamiltonians, because this is pretty much unexplored for the time being. And finally, one possible building block for this extension to k-local interactions would be to have these quasi-factorizations for the relative entropy for many more systems in parallel and not just for two systems. So it's a natural question to see whether this can be done or not. And maybe the way to go is actually to provide some new functional inequalities that are different than the ones that we've been considering all along. So maybe defining some functional inequalities, differentiating the Pelavkin-Stachetsky relative entropy instead of the usual relative entropy. Maybe this gives you something different that is easier to deal with or whatever. So these are many possible open problems and lines of research starting from here. And this is mostly what I wanted to tell you today. So thank you very much for your attention.
Sorry, could I make a quick announcement? Sorry, I just, on behalf of Debbie, she just told me that there's another talk by Mio Murao in IQC, and I think some people wanted to go to that, and I've been put in charge to take people there if anybody doesn't know what IQC is. So we're going to go right now.
Yeah, so
it's
take questions.
Sure. What's the time?
So for your Hamiltonian, if you add a very weak local perturbation, do you think there's any step that one can make?
It's a great question. It's actually something that I'm very interested in, but I'm not sure what you can say there, because for me, what would be interesting would be that the mixing time is something that you're defining over the Limbladian, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it would be great if adding a small perturbation, so you're saying to the Hamiltonian, and therefore modifying slightly the Gibbs state, gives you some small modification over the Limbladian associated to the thing,
so that
you keep the rapid mixing property, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is something that is pretty much unknown, and it's a huge open question. So I would love that to be true, but
I see.
But yeah, it's unknown in general.
Mm-hmm.
What some things that are known are that if you have a Limbladian that has all these nice properties, and you add a small perturbation to the Limbladian itself,
mm-hmm.
and the initial Limbladian has rapid mixing, then the perturbed one still has rapid mixing.
Mm-hmm.
So if adding this perturbation to the Hamiltonian gave a Limbladian that is only a perturbation of the original one, but this is the huge arrow that is missing there. So
I see.
That's a very interesting question, yeah. And I mean, the reason why I love that in particular is because adding a perturbation to a commuting Hamiltonian could make it highly non-commuting.
Right.
And then this would give you like very exotic behaviors there, no, for the Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
it could really improve the amount of results that you have
mm-hmm.
here. But
I see.
Yeah. So to have an idea, you know, to have some intuition as a physicist, on your result, you know, some of the examples you are talking about, you know, these quantum doubles and, you know, theta F toric code or things like that, these are indeed trivial models in the sense that, you know, they are all commuting. They are stabilizer.
Yeah.
They are, you know, pretty simple. Indeed, those models essentially have dimensional reduction. Are essentially, you know, quantum models in one representation, but indeed their dual models are all classical ones. So do you have any example of a model that is non-trivial? Okay, so it's commuting, it's a non-trivial model. Quantum spin, let's talk about quantum spin model. It's a non-trivial model that you have, you know, is not frustration free. Commutes all the terms and you can prove rapid mixing. Do you have any example of a Hamiltonian like this?
It's a very, very good question. Not for the moment, to be honest, not for the moment, because we have the limitation here that, I mean, if you go to 1D, I guess everything is quite simple, no? Because we are considering models that are K-local, but still they are commuting, they are translation invariant, so I guess this is still pretty simple. if you, I mean, you have there, for example, the cluster state or something like that, but it's not really like super interesting, no? But if you go to higher D, the problem is that everything that we can prove for the time being is for two local interactions. So even if they are commuting, they are too local. So
I see.
So I don't know. I mean, for me, all these projects, it's more a proof of concept thing, or however you say that, no? In the sense that we are creating the whole set of tools and the whole strategy, and we are really expecting that by leveraging them a little bit more, following these open questions that I'm saying here, we are going to be able to really say something meaningful, as you're saying, for all these more complicated models. But for the time being,
okay.
I mean, for the time being, one of our main goals is to try to be able to extend this, not even only for the 2D toric code, because I agree that this is already pretty much explored, but to be able to say something for higher dimensional toric codes, for example, because if you're able to completely close the circle, having k-local interactions, and then you can study how correlations decay on this kind of higher dimensional toric codes, then you can say when they are rapidly mixing and when they are not. And actually, there, not everything is known. So there you can really say something that is original.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, if you take the 3D version of it, the toric code, what happens is that the universality class of the problem changes from, the 1D classicalizing to the 3D classicalizing.
Exactly.
It jumps.
Exactly.
And that is a non-trivial thing.
Exactly.
So that is, from the point of view of mixing, this is going to start being non-trivial.
Exactly.
So yeah, I agree. I mean, this is what I was asking you. I mean, examples like that, if you have some, proofs or example of this sort. Okay, so thank you very much.
Maybe ask me in a year or so, and maybe I can say yes.
There we go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Sorry, I mentioned at some point that there is this proof of the Davis generator for commuting Hamiltonians that are gapped.
Yes.
Can you give what are the conditions and what does it imply for the correlation structure for those statistics? So if it's gapped, can you say that, is it true that the...
You mean this thing?
This is the generalization of previously known results.
Yes.
So, what does it imply for the correlations structure of the steady state? Like, is it?
When you have that Dellin-Bladian is gapped, you know that there's exponential decay of correlations using just the covariance.
Uh-huh.
So using this, I don't know if you can see that, but using this here, so you know that having a gap in Dellin-Bladian implies this kind of exponential decay of the covariance.
Does it go the other way?
It goes the other way, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's this thing that was proven before us, like by Castorian and Brandao.
I see. So it can prove that if the decay of covariance is, it doesn't decay that fast, then you can show that it's actually has to be gapless.
No, actually, it's the other way around. It has to decay pretty fast because it decays exponentially fast with the distance between A and B. So it's actually the other way around. For things to thermalize relatively fast, you need the decay of correlations. You need correlations to decay very fast between spatially separated regions.
No, I'm saying that suppose that correlations don't decay fast.
Ah, okay.
Can I say something about the gap of the...
Yeah, because this is an equivalence, so yeah.
Okay.
You can say that in the limit you're going to have a closing gap.
Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Thanks.
But for this very specific model, of course.
I see.
Okay, well, let's think.
Yeah, one quick question. So you assume that you have a unique fixed point. What if you have you have multiple fixed points?
Then the situation gets very complicated because already for classical systems, the situation gets super complicated when you have that. Because the problem is that then you can have, imagine that you are interested in your system converging to one specific fixed point, no? Then the problem is that it could converge too fast to the sink of attraction of the other fixed point, and then you will have to jump it out, in a sense. So you would have to, already for classical spin systems, this requires a lot of techniques and a lot of different things that are unexplored here yet, so.
Also, your sigmoidal detail balance condition, can it be relaxed to something like KMS?
KMS.
Well, KMS is a weaker version of detail balance, right? So KMS doesn't
Definitely, yeah. No, no, what I was calling here the detail balance was for KMS, but I agree with you. Usually detail balance is called for GNS. So what I was using here was already the weak one, was the KMS.
So the KMS is, we define the sigma inner product.
Yeah.
But the KMS means the sigma inner product is given by sigma minus 1/2 dot sigma minus 1/2. But
yeah, yeah.
There is sigma.
No, no, here it was with 1/2 and 1/2.
Oh, okay.
It was at the beginning, sorry. No, I was already taking the weak one because for the models that we are considering here, we know that it is satisfied. So it was this one here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's just that then the covariance, I was defining it with the GNS because we know that both of them are equivalent because Castellan-Brandão proved it, and then it's easier to understand it with the GNS. But no, the one that we are using is for the KMS, yeah. I completely agree.
Okay, well, we can take other questions offline, but let's thank Angelica.
Thank you very much.